The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got plenty of questions. We've also going to continue our celebration, if you will, or maybe recognition is a better word, the recognition of Annuity Awareness Month. I didn't know such a thing even existed until Jim pointed it out last week, but we'll continue with that by answering an annuity question for sure on the show, but I'm sure we have a mixed bag of stuff to start with. A Social Security question, as usual, is my suspicion, but we'll bring Jim on here and see what he wants to get to first.
As always, we're going to do, hi, Chris. Hi, everybody. Didn't mean to barge in on you like that.
No problem.
But as always, we'll lead with Social Security. But if you stop and think about it, Chris and folks, Social Security is just one big-ass annuity, is it not?
Yeah, complicated. In its own right? It's got odd rules. There's no other annuity that has the same rules as this, but it certainly is a form of an annuity. It happens to have an inflation adjustment built in, which is a very attractive part when you're the recipient of an annuity. When you're the payer of the annuity, you don't like the inflation adjustment, but when you're receiving it, inflation adjustment's great.
Especially since private annuities no longer offer inflation adjustments tied to CPI. Just Social Security does that at this point, and some private pensions, some private pensions and tons of government pensions do that. But you can't buy a private annuity on your own with a COLA adjustment. The Principal was the last insurance company to offer those. And I think it was about four to six years ago now. They stopped offering those. You can get income annuity payments that will increase by a stated amount every year,
right?
But not by the unknown CPI. That would be a true inflation-adjusted COLA, cost of living adjustment. You could buy, and New York Life is one of the few companies that has such a wide variety that you can choose anything from 1 to 10% increase per year. The reason companies still offer those listeners and not CPI, well, I'll let Chris answer because I know he knows the answer. Why would a company be okay pricing a known increase but no longer will allow a CPI increase, even though, Chris, CPI might be lower in some years than the actual increase they agreed to?
Well, when you're playing the game that the insurance companies do, it's all about the known. You hit the nail on the head with the known and unknown variables there. A known increase they can plan for. There's nothing unexpected happening. They can build their portfolio to support the annuity payments, knowing these increases have to happen. You might say, well, they don't know how long I'm going to live. Well, they actually don't care because they aren't just insuring you. They're not just paying you. They're going to pay thousands of people in your pool, and they don't need to know when you're going to die. They just need to know on average how many people are going to die every year, and it turns out that's very predictable. So they've really just taken away that last unknown variable in the CPI from their situation, and it just makes them, you know, much more able to run their business predictably.
Right. And the reason you see Social Security, government pensions, such as at the state, local level, in addition to the federal government with their TSP plan, the reason you see a lot of governments still offering CPI increases, and I'm being totally serious on this, I'm not being facetious, governments operate in a devoid of economic reality environment, if you will.
Well, it's partly that, but also their revenues are driven a bit by CPI as well, unlike an insurance company.
Yeah, but they're also controlled by the public sector unions, and they're all in bed with
well,
each other.
Well, they're certainly,
they,
I agree.
They don't have to worry about
variables there. Yeah,
right. But they don't make a profit. They don't have to worry about that. They're not going to go out of business.
Right.
They have an unlimited ability to get revenue simply by taxation. So they operate in a world devoid of economic reality, whereas private annuity companies, say what you want about insurance companies, you still want them to be profitable and survive. Why? They're carrying a tremendous amount of obligations. You don't want them to go out of business. So in the real world, if you will, that last unknown variable, how much will CPI be every single year? It's impossible for them to predict. So they got rid of it. So anyways, I just wanted to share a little bit of it in this National Annuity Month, which I didn't even know existed until I got an email from the sponsors of National Annuity Month, the National Fixed Indexed Annuity Association. So, of course, the association decides June is National Annuity Month. We certainly didn't decide that.
Right.
But I think it's a good opportunity. And again, annuities are like a four-letter word. Oh, my God. And it's just, we want, especially if you do it yourselfers, it's like you have to sit there and listen to the word annuity, even though you've been trained to hate annuities. So this is very painful for you. We just want to help give people information. That's all we've ever done on this podcast for years, well over a decade. That's all we're going to do is give you information. We're very open with you on this show that we don't hate annuities and we don't love annuities. I have a love-hate relationship with annuities, I like to say. There's some I like, and there's some, even now, Chris, I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. They're disgusting, and I feel bad for anyone buying them. It's still an industry that you have to enter into with caution, yeah, with true caution, because there are some annuities, like I said, I truly think are good, and there's some annuities that, in my opinion, are being offered for no other reason except to make the insurance company offering them very wealthy and to pay the broker selling them a hefty commission. So you got to be careful. But when we say annuity, we are talking a lifetime guaranteed stream of income. That's why I said Social Security before we get to today's Social Security question. That's why I said Social Security is just one, I said big ass, but big annuity. Because that's what it is. It is a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Every single annuity is an insurance product. What is the insurance protection you are buying? Longevity. I don't care what kind of annuity you buy, immediate, deferred, fixed or variable, qualified or non-qualified. I don't care what type of annuity you purchase. It will always come with a guaranteed lifetime stream of income. Every annuity, which is a noun, can have an action applied to it, a verb, annuitization. Every annuity can be annuitized into a lifetime stream of income. Some annuities will annuitize into a very good and beneficial and valuable lifetime stream of income, and other annuities have a real crappy lifetime stream of income. But without a doubt, every single annuity comes with a lifetime stream of income. They are an insurance product geared towards longevity risk, outliving your money. Now, annuities also offer another type of protection besides longevity, and that's principal protection. You will always receive your money back. Not every annuity, Chris, do they? Not every annuity offers that. Some annuities, called variable annuities, do not give 100% principal protection. Right. You can get less than what you put in. I cringe at the number of times people with variable annuities either reach out to me via the podcast, considering becoming a client and are interviewing with us. Now, I don't do many of those interviews anymore, but for years I did. Or are already a client. And during our weekly team meetings at our firm, we all meet and plan as a team and involve everybody in decisions with clients. So sometimes during those meetings, it's brought to my attention that this person or that person has XYZ annuity. And my first question when one of our junior advisors mentions they have an annuity, my first question is always, what, Chris?
Why did they buy it?
Why did they buy it? And my team needs to know. They know that's one of the things they have to get the information on. And sometimes we hear they bought it for principal protection, and I'm looking at a variable annuity.
Yeah.
And it makes me cringe because it tells me the person selling it either had no idea what the person was actually trying to protect, or the person buying it totally misunderstood. But a variable annuity does not give principal protection. Some do, the vast majority do not. But every annuity has a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. So the reason I'm making a big deal over National Annuity Awareness Month, which again, is a joke. I didn't even know it existed until a couple of weeks ago. I just thought this would be a great time to talk about annuities. But I'm talking about annuities in the sense Chris and I believe in them. And that is a lifetime stream of guaranteed income that the younger you can start putting in place and use it to supplement Social Security, which is nothing more than a big inflation-adjusted annuity because it's a lifetime stream of guaranteed income you cannot outlive, and to supplement those of you lucky enough to have a pension, which is an annuity, a lifetime stream of income you cannot outlive, to supplement both those more traditional lifetime streams of income with additional lifetime streams of income to cover your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. If you're a new listener, you might not have any idea what I just said for these past 3 or 4 minutes. Listen to previous podcasts to hear what Chris and I passionately believe in as an appropriate approach to funding your retirement. And for those Vanguardians who stick with us and listen to us every week and are trying to learn, I think you understand why we believe in this. We try to tell people the younger you has an unmitigated responsibility?
No.
Or is that the wrong word? No, not unmitigated.
No, I probably wouldn't use that, no.
That's such an impressive sounding word. Unrelenting? Un-anything? What word am I looking for?
I don't remember what you usually say there.
A blank responsibility to make sure the older you has enough money to cover their minimum dignity floor. Unwavering. Yeah, how's that?
That might work. I usually say an absolute obligation or something like that.
Absolute.
Yeah.
Unmitigated?
Kind of would work, I think. But you used to say something else, and now I'm trying to remember what you used to say there.
I don't know. My mouth says something that my brain's not even thinking. Let's go with unwavering. You have an unwavering responsibility, the younger you, and that could be the 60, 65, 70-year-old you. You may not feel young at this age. I'm 58. I don't feel young at this age. I had a stroke a year and a half ago. My back hurts and leg hurts as I try to garden nowadays. When I go out, I realize I can get the senior discount. I'm the old dude in the room. I don't feel young anymore because I know I'm aging. But 30 years from now, if I'm still alive at 88, I'm going to look back at 58, Chris, and say, God, I remember when I used to think I was old at 58. I would kill to be 58. The thing is, I, as a 58-year-old, have an unwavering responsibility to make sure the older Jim, the 78 and maybe 88, if good Lord allows, 98-year-old Jim, can take care of, if at the very least, my minimum dignity floor and the lifestyle that I have grown accustomed to, which is the minimum dignity floor, so I can have the same health care and housing and transportation and utilities and food, I said it backwards that time, that I have grown accustomed to, and to cover that with a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Because as you age and as I age, and I do this for a living, I am not going to have the ability or the mastery over my finances in 30 years that I do now. But I do know in 30 years, barring any cognitive decline of Alzheimer's or dementia, I may not quite understand everything that's going on, but I will know on X day of every month, I'm getting my Social Security check, although you all know it's going to be very small for me. I'm going to have my Social Security check. I'm going to have my Roth annuity checked. I talk openly about that annuity, but I'm also going to have a real big annuity that I will buy on my own to cover my shortage, because I will have a very big shortage in covering my minimum dignity floor. We just believe passionately in that. And that's where we put annuities into mm-hmm. our practice and our beliefs. Anything you want to add on that, Chris, before we get to the Social Security question? I'm just trying to let people know we're not here to talk about pushing annuities. And I want people to understand by annuity, we mean lifetime stream of guaranteed income.
Yeah, the only thing I'd maybe just extend a little bit and say then the other expenses, the more discretionary, we call them fun or desired expenses, we don't generally, although we have some people that have enough secure income that it contributes to covering some fun expenses, but we don't really push people or encourage people to try to cover those with annuitized secure income. It's just our philosophy that we're trying to build an absolute foundational floor, if you will, for the minimum dignity floor expenses. So we find it imperative that that be covered whether you have assets or not. And really the only way to do that is with the secure income. But the more discretionary spending, which honestly will decline over time, usually for people who age, they're going to have a real, you know, aggressive go-go period and spend a lot of money on fun if they follow our general guidance. But there's no need to have annuitized income for that necessarily. So I just wanted to make that distinction that we're not talking about creating secure income for everything. It's just to create that appropriate foundation. And everything's a balance or a trade-off. And we just find the sweet spot is to cover that minimum dignity floor with the secure income. And that provides you with the foundation that makes most people comfortable then to enjoy their fun with the rest of their assets.
All righty. Perfect. Enough of that. Let's get into the actual Q's and our A's as well. So we're going to lead with a Social Security question like we always do. And it begins. I don't know where they're from. Hold on a second. No? No idea. Okay. But anyways, we did receive this and it begins. Here is my question. My husband began collecting his Social Security, and you might want to write these things down, Chris, his Social Security at 70. I am an 11 and a half years younger than my husband. Okay. I am now approaching my full retirement age of 66 and 4 months. And I'm wondering if I should start collecting my spousal benefit. I know the spousal benefit doesn't increase any longer after my full retirement age. But I also understand once I file, I am deemed to file for all benefits of which I'm entitled and would have to take the higher of my benefit or my spousal. My benefit at my full retirement age will be $1,600. As best as I can tell, if I begin at my full retirement age, as best as I can tell now, if I begin my spousal benefit at my full retirement age, it would actually be pretty close to my benefit of $1,600 a month. Most likely less, but not by much. So therefore, I wouldn't really be collecting my spousal at all, would I? If I file at my full retirement age, I'm going to be collecting my Social Security. And it will be deemed to be mine. I'm not quite sure what she means by that, Chris. Hopefully you do. But they would not call it spousal. The Social Security Administration will call it mine. Mm-hmm. So what I'm asking is, should I collect at my full retirement age? Or do you think I should wait to 70? What would the break even be, and would it be worth it if I waited? Is there a reason you can think of not to begin collecting at my full retirement age? Let me add, we do not need my Social Security to live on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So ultimately, the larger benefit, she made it pretty clear that her husband has the larger benefit. Plus, he waited till 70, making it the biggest it could possibly be. And he's been collecting now for quite a while. By my judgment, he's about 78 years old. So he's been collecting now for about 8 years. She's approaching her full retirement age. Her benefit, $1,597, is bigger than the spousal. So when she reaches her full retirement age, at no time will she ever get a spousal. So let's clear that up. Her benefit is always going to be bigger than the spousal. So when you go into file, they give you the bigger of the two. There'd be no reason to claim the lower one at this point. She made kind of a comment that I want to clear up for people. She was alluding to being too old or being too young, to be grandfathered into the restricted application strategy that we previously would talk about. We talk about it occasionally because a few people can still do it for another couple of years. But what that was the ability at her full retirement age to claim just the spousal and let her own grow. We called it, you know, being paid to wait. Normally waiting to 70, she's going to give up her, we'll call it $1,600 a month. But if she could have claimed the spousal, she could have gotten the $1,430 per month during that time. She cannot do that because the only people who are still allowed to do that technique is people who were born before January 2nd of 1954. So she misses the cutoff or the grandfathering in for that. So for her, it's really just looking at the face value of her benefit being bigger than the spousal. Spousal's out of the picture for her. So now the question is, should she claim now or later? Well, that's the age-old, does it make sense to delay or not? And she referred to a break-even point. The break-even for this decision is almost always in your mid-80s. So just so you know, when you're looking at an independent decision, not a coordinated claiming with a spouse, but just the should I, her in this case, claim at full retirement age or age 70? When do I break even? When will I get enough money coming back in to make up for the 3.5 years or so, the 44 months, I think, is what she's got of delay. Going to be in her early, you know, probably 83, 84, somewhere in there. I don't like looking at it like that. I think that's kind of a, then you're just kind of playing a game, is am I going to beat the clock kind of a thing. And I think it's better to look at more important things like, do I need the money now or later? How does their minimum dignity floor coverage look as a couple? And I say as a couple because when the first of them passes, hers is going to go away. So it's generally less important for her to delay to 70 when you're looking at it from the perspective of covering minimum dignity floor expenses, which is part of our philosophy. But I'd look at that and see, maybe they have an extra big minimum dignity floor and they're really in need of extra secure income while both of them are alive. And one way to do it would be to delay. Now, the other thing that's going to factor in is the age of her husband. Just now we're going to look at statistically the odds here are much more in favor of her claiming early than later when you factor that in, because, you know, we have to be realistic here. Him being 11 and a half years older, it's highly likely he'll be the first to pass and her benefit's going to go away at that point. So the chances that both of them live an extraordinarily long time is reduced when one of them is so much older, which reduces the attractiveness of her delaying to 70. So those are some of the kind of statistical or mathematical reasons, but I'd stand back and look at the, you know, what's going to provide you with the most value. And she made the comment, boy, it'd be sure nice to have that extra money over the next 44 months or so. If they could go out and do some more things, I would, I guess I'm arguing a little bit of both sides here, but I would, in their case, I would point out, hey, would this extra money allow you to do some things before your husband gets too old to do them? He's already 78. Maybe he's already slowed down. Are there a few things that you're not able to do because of money that if you had this coming in, you could go and take one last trip or one last hurrah or one throw one last big party or, you know, who knows what before your husband just declines enough physically or, you know, mentally where you're not able to do some things and then you never get to enjoy them together. That would be an overriding factor for me to argue for her to claim now. If someone was really pressuring me, pushed me up against the wall and said, you've got to make a decision for her, given what you know, what would you say? I would lean towards claiming at full retirement age, given all that I know about this situation, which is not the whole story. You know, I know what she shared, and there very well could be reasons that would justify her waiting to 70. But because of his age, because she said they don't really need it, that implies they have plenty of other resources. I'm leaning towards her taking it, because I don't think that her benefit is actually going to be around that long, relatively, because his will be the one that continues when the first of them passes. Hers is much more short-lived in my prediction. I don't know for sure, but that's where I would lean toward in this case.
I agree. When I read the email, that was my thoughts as well. The husband waited to 70. He's got the larger benefit. Mm-hmm. At the death of one of them, that's the only benefit to continue. And she said they don't need it. So why wait? Why wait for a larger benefit? Your husband's 11 and a half years older than you, and he's going to die first because he's the guy. And he's much older than you. Yeah. What if he dies 2, 3, 4 years into it? I just can't see waiting. You wait to 70. Your husband is 81 and a half. Call it 82. What if he only lives to 83 or 84? And then you waited all this time to get to 70, and then you're not even going to get anything for it. If you would have said, we need this income, we absolutely need it, I'd be thinking a little differently. But you said you don't need it, so it tells me you might as well turn it on. I would. If it were me, if this was my wife, if this was my mom, if this was my sister, I would most likely be turning hers on. Now, as Chris pointed out, and we want this listener to understand, we don't have the full situation.
Yeah.
So we are assuming an awful lot here. I definitely would talk to an advisor if you have one handy, or talk to your husband, or look at your finances. But if you have enough money in a survivorship scenario to cover your minimum dignity floor without your Social Security, because that's going to be gone when your husband passes away, you're only going to have his Social Security and whatever other sources of secure income you have, pension or income annuity. If those amounts of secure income cover your minimum dignity floor, food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare, there's another reason you need not wait. But even if she waited, Chris,
it's not going to help her. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's going to be lost at your husband's death. And there's such a large age difference between you, and men generally pass away 7 years before women anyway. You could be a widower for 20 plus years. Living off of his Social Security and any pension and annuity income you have, plus savings. I would start drawing your Social Security now. That's going to help mm-hmm. your savings
right.
continue to grow.
Right.
Because you say you don't need it. That's telling me you've got more money and assets than you need. Bring some more in.
Yeah.
Oh, horror.
Even just sock it away to help reduce the pain of losing your benefit when the first of you passes.
Precisely. It's my thoughts exactly.
Yeah.
So again, we don't have the full picture, but that's where we would be leaning. So this isn't advice to go out and do it. It's advice to, hey, you might want to consider it. And this is what we would consider doing.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're not in a financial planning relationship, but I'm sure she knows that. Okay. let's get into now some other emails we got. We got the new question of the week, and then we have a couple of annuity questions that we're going to get to. But a few things I need to point out beforehand. First, someone rightfully pointed out you made another mistake last week.
Uh-oh.
Yep. Without a doubt, you made a mistake last week. So I will address this now and apologize on behalf of myself and my staff for Chris's error. So he begins, Chris rarely makes errors, but he made an obvious error when he neglected to correct Jim on a Jimism.
Wait a minute, a Jimism needs no correction. The whole point of it is it's defective at face value. But anyway, go ahead. I can't wait to hear this.
That hurt. On Q&A show 2223 at the 5249 mark, so this guy really went down and drilled into you. He's taking you to task. Jim referred to the fees on annuities as being exuberant. Maybe he was referring to how the insurance agent feels when selling it. But not as the description of the amount of fees that was paid by the client.
He's absolutely right. I made a horrible mistake. I did not pick up on that. I didn't hear that. I would have remembered that. Sometimes I hear it and I let it pass because it's kind of obnoxious for me to interrupt all the time. But I always remember them. So I do not recall him saying that. I believe you do, since you've nailed it with the timestamp on the thing. So I apologize for my error that I didn't pick up on exuberant fees.
Well, I wrote back to this gentleman, savvy as he is, and I said, yes, you are very savvy to have picked up on how I was testing Chris and his obvious error in failing to pick on my completely on purpose misuse of the word exuberant. I will make sure to point this out to him on next week's show.
So it was all a test.
But then I wanted to test this gentleman. So I said, but hypothetically speaking, if someone, not me, of course, did not quite know what word he was trying to pronounce, how would you spell that word? Again, purely hypothetical. And he wrote back and said, hypothetically, the word I would spell would be exorbitant.
No.
So, see?
What do you mean? That's what it, because the exorbitant is the word, not exorbitant.
Oh, damn it. All right. Well, see, I was testing you again.
So
Very good.
I passed this time. Thank you.
You passed. Excellent. Excellent. Exorbitant.
There you go. Did he use the R in there, or is that you?
No, I put the I in there to test you. Okay.
Of course. Well, thank you for the
purely test.
To purely
test you.
I definitely need it, the testing, constantly.
Okay. All righty. So thank you.
Is that related
you.
To this question, or is that a segue?
Absolutely not. Okay. But every time people point out a mistake you make, I'm going to go out of my way. I'll be on my deathbed, and I'll be, give me the mic. Give me the mic. It'll be the last thing I do will be to point out another mistake you make. Okay. The question of the week is a continuation of I think it was last week or the week before. Do you remember the woman who in 2000 put $2,000 in a Roth in 1999?
Okay. Yep. That whole. Yes.
So, folks, she wrote back to me, listener and listeners in general, but especially to the woman who wrote again, you are truly making a mountain out of a molehill. You see a tremendous amount of things you think are impacting you, and none of them are. The best I can make out, and I'm not going to read her whole email because it is very confusing. This poor woman is overanalyzing this till the cows come home. The best I can see is you made an excess contribution to a Roth, and that's what we will talk about. But she added some clarity. And with what she was saying, I truly do feel she made an excess contribution of $2,000 to a Roth 22 years ago. She is seeing every conceivable twist, turn, and rabbit hole, and she's getting overly confused and panicking. Let's just walk through listener and listeners because she added some more clarity. So if you, everybody remembers, hopefully, if you listen to these shows in order, in 2000, in March of 2000, she put $2,000 into a Roth IRA for a 1999 contribution. Perfectly legal, correct, Chris?
When you're allowed, yes.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Totally allowed. You have till April 15th of the following year to put in money into an IRA for the previous year. She put in $2,000 in 1999 for a Roth. Excuse me. In 2000, she put in $2,000 for a 1999 contribution. At the same time, she put in another $2,000 for a year 2000 contribution. But in May of 2000, she got married and realized, oh, goodness, we're going to have too much combined income for me to make a Roth contribution. Mm-hmm. So she wanted to recharacterize it to an IRA contribution. That's what she wanted to do. So she adds some clarity. And she tells me, I had an excess contribution in the year 2000. Correct, listener. Mm-hmm. You did. Then she wrote, I'm not sure how I ever checked that it was recharacterized. Should I call the IRS? Only if you are a glutton for punishment would you want to call the IRS on this?
Plus, they're not even going to know. Right.
They're going to have no freaking clue if you did it. Because she shares with me, and see if I can find it. I'm trying not to read her whole email. Where does she say that? Okay. In June, I did the paperwork for the recharacterization. Except, oh, she put somewhere, but she's, I can't find it. Listen, she has a big email here, but she admits she doesn't know if she actually sent it in. So she says, I don't see a corrected 5498 or a 1099 or a form 8606. So let me pause there to her and to everyone listening. You are never going to see, quote unquote, see or receive a form 8606. Why? You're supposed to do 8606,
right?
Not the custodian and certainly not the IRS. The custodian sends the 1099. The IRS sends the 5498. The 8606, listener and listeners in general, is your responsibility. And the 8606 is filed not when you put money in a Roth IRA. It's when you put money in a traditional IRA and don't deduct it.
Right. Which is what the recharacterization would have done.
Correct. So you would have done an 8606 if you recharacterized, because you put it in a traditional IRA. And as Chris rightly pointed out last week, we don't think you ever deducted it. If you did recharacterize, and I don't think she ever did, if you did recharacterize, you, not the custodian, not the IRS, would have had to file 8606 to document you put $2,000 into an IRA and did not deduct it. The fact that you don't see an 8606 tells me you might have never filed it. The other thing that tells me you never did the recharacterization, and this went through me for a loop and I had to research it. She said, no 1099. And I thought, well, a recharacterization is a trustee-to-trustee transfer. Mm-hmm. A trustee-to-trustee transfer of an IRA never receives a 1099. Right. So I got a hold of the Edslot group, and they confirmed that. Mm-hmm. And then quickly followed with a correction email and said, Jim, we never realized this. There is an obscure rule in 1099s. And a 1099 will be issued on a recharacterization. I did not know that. Neither did they. They had to research it.
Oh.
So, yeah. Oh, is right. When
but
you do a trustee to trustee.
You're saying she didn't get one?
She didn't get one.
Oh.
because she confirmed she didn't get a 1099, it's telling me
she never
did the recharacterization.
Yep.
No 8606, no 1099.
Yep.
It's telling me you never did it. And then no 5498 showing money going into a traditional IRA. Ma'am, you never recharacterized the $2,000 Roth contribution you made in 2000. Everything else you wrote after that in your email, goodness, just delete it. You're going down all these holes, these what ifs, the gain, the loss, the deduction, oh my Lord. Push it all aside and let's look at what I think you did. What you did is what you didn't do, and that is recharacterize. For the life of me, I don't think you recharacterized. She even admits later, Chris, if you remember, she moved that IRA, which was with some company called Northwest or something, I forget, and she moved it to Charles Schwab into a Roth. Well, you moved a Roth to a Roth. You never recharacterized it. Last week, we thought she made a conversion and never declared it as income.
But that would only have been if she actually successfully did the recharacterization, which now
exactly. Clearly
she doesn't appear to have.
Mm-hmm. You didn't do the recharacterization, right. Listener. You have no 8606 and no 1099, which strangely is required to be issued on a trustee-to-trustee transfer, even with the same custodian, when doing a recharacterization.
But you didn't get one.
You didn't get one.
Yep.
So 22 years ago, listener, you made an excess contribution to a Roth IRA.
Yep.
And you're asking me today how to fix it? I can't say you should do this, that, or the other thing. If you want to fix it, here's what you would need to do. You need to do a corrective withdrawal from your Roth IRA of $2,000 22 years later. You need to then file Form 50. Oh, gosh, I always forget this. Is it 5498, Chris? 53. Okay. Chris is going to get me the form in a second. I can't keep these form numbers straight. You're going to then have to file the form that Chris is about to
name. 5329.
To
report additional taxes on IRAs. This is going to be, she's going to have to pay the penalties. Yep.
Correct. This is the mea culpa. Mm-hmm. I made a boo-boo.
Yep.
I owe you a 6% penalty. Now, she thinks, in her email, she said, should I just pay the IRS $120? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking to myself, how did she come up with $120?
Yeah.
Well, 6% of 2,000. She thinks she just owes a measly 100. And, I think it was 120. Is that 6% of 2,000?
It is, but that's not it.
Okay. That's not it, listener. What you need to do is file the form 5329, right? 5329?
Yep.
5329 for the year 2000 and pay a 6% penalty on that. Then for the year 2001, you have to determine, do I still owe a penalty? Well, if you stopped working and your new husband stopped working and you guys were not allowed to ever, ever, ever contribute to another IRA from 2001 on, you will have to file Form 5329 for each year for the last 22 years. Mm-hmm. You actually have to use the 5329 from that year. So you have to go to the IRS's website, or nowadays just Google it, 5329 for year 2000, 5329 for year 2001. You got to do that 22 times. You have to get the Form 5329, and it's a 6% penalty for each year that money stayed in there. It does not compound. That's the good news. It's only $2,000. It's a static amount. The earnings actually get to sit inside the Roth.
You got
to
leave the earnings in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can leave the earnings in there. The 6% penalty is on the $2,000 that never came out. The only time you take the earnings out, now I'm getting a little deep into the rabbit hole to help all listeners, she would have technically had until October 1st of 2001 to fix this. Had she fixed it before October 1st of 2001, she has to take out the $2,000 plus any earnings minus any growth. But after October 15th of 2001, any earnings can stay in there. Any earnings that compounded over the past 22 years on that $2,000 can stay in the Roth. It's a magical thing. She only has to pay a 6% annual penalty on that $2,000 that stayed in the Roth every year. So that's why I painted the worst case scenario, Chris, is that they stopped working the year after marriage and she was never eligible to contribute to a Roth ever again. Ma'am, do you want to do this? But I'm just explaining what you have to do. However, there is a stroke of good news to make you feel a little more comfortable. Every year that you were eligible to contribute to a Roth and didn't, you never tell me if you ever kept contributing to a Roth. Every year that you were eligible but never contributed, you can reduce that $2,000 by your eligible contribution amount until it disappears.
Right. So maybe some year later, suddenly that would stop. So she would have 6% penalties for a while, and then hopefully it would stop. But worst case, if she was never able to make another dollar of contribution to a Roth, she'd owe 6% times 22 on $2,000, so $120 times 22. And if she actually did remove the $2,000, then the pain and suffering would stop and it would go. So she'd owe more in penalties than the $2,000, but that would stop the penalty process by removing that $2,000 now here in 2022.
My gut tells me over that 22-year period, she was eligible at one point.
Yep.
Maybe even the very next year, listener. Maybe in 2001, you were eligible to put $2,000 or more in, and you and your husband, you didn't. It was in your IRA, not your husband's, and you didn't. Mm-hmm. And boom, that $2,000 excess contribution is wiped out. It's wiped out every year by the amount you are allowed to contribute but didn't. For every year it stayed in there and was not wiped out, you owe 6% penalty. And you must pay that penalty on Form 5329 for that year. So, is it worth doing, listener? Personally, I don't think so. The IRS, honestly, you are a small fish. They're not looking for this. I can't tell you not to do it. I gave you the instructions on how to fix it. But is it worth it? You are well past the statute of limitations. The IRS's software is not geared. There's no way they're going to even find this. They're not searching. Well, let's look for every taxpayer in 2000 who put money in a Roth, and let's match it up and make sure they're eligible to do that. They don't have the ability 22 years later to even do that. So I'm saying you might be making a mountain out of a molehill.
Well, but even if she bites the bullet and pays all the penalties, it's not the end of the world. We're talking about couple of $1,000 here, $2,500 in penalties or something, and the problem is definitely gone. So it's we're not talking a massive thing here. It would be a lot of paperwork to go back and file all those 5329s, but I agree. I think it would be a, especially now that she's changed custodians and all the mess that's happened and all the stuff that's happened between then and now.
There's no way they're going to find this.
I don't think there's any, and you could run you could proactively do it, and then you've confined the problem, or you could see, if they come knocking on the door and then you say, I'm sorry, I didn't, I owe it, and penalize me, and you'll owe the penalty and anything else they choose to do to you.
Exactly. If you are losing sleep because you might owe the U.S. government a little bit of money, then by all means, rectify this.
Yeah.
If it were me, I know what I would do, but that's me, and I'm not going to share what I would do on the show. Maybe I would fix it. Maybe I would ignore it. You decide. We can't tell you to ignore it. We can't tell you must fix it. We're just explaining to you the reality of the situation. 22 years ago, you put $2,000 into a Roth that you were not eligible to put in because you got married. That's the facts. Can the IRS find it? Are they actively looking for it? Is it worth fixing? You are way overthinking this with everything else you wrote. Just throw that all out. you made a $2,000 excess contribution from the best I can see 22 years ago. You decide if you want to fix it. In a perfect, in her best scenario is the very next year she was eligible to put $2,000 into a Roth. She never did. And boom, it's wiped out. And you don't have anything else to worry about except the IRS maybe someday catching you on one $2,000 excess contribution and you're going to owe $120 on that. Let them find you and then pay them the $120 plus some penalties for late payment on it. But they're never going to find you in my oh so humble yet possibly completely wrong opinion that they're never going to find this. All right. Anyways, I just wanted to throw that out there. What she does is up to her. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we then got some annuity questions in, and I'm going to actually answer them because I'm trying to answer annuity questions during National Annuity Awareness Month. Okay. So this comes from a listener in Bloomington, Indiana. Oh, Illinois, rather. I thought Bloomington was in Indiana. Maybe I guess there's one in Illinois, too.
Could be.
I did not realize that. Bloomington, Illinois. Signed his name George, but gave us his real name. He says, hi, Bugs and Cowboy. Really enjoy the podcast in the short, to-the-point, no-nonsense, serious, no-detoured discussion that you and Chris provide us. Clearly, a long-term listener knows exactly how this podcast works.
Yeah. Bloomington's near Peoria.
Oh, is it? Mm-hmm. Okay. He says, I have an annuity question. I had this annuity question in my brain for a long time. Given that sometimes people with health problems like you and me, Jim, I do. He's right. I have a health problem. I have AFib, which led to a very significant stroke, and cannot get life insurance because they may die early. Are there breaks given to those people to buy an income annuity because they may die early? And the annuity insurance company would be able to pocket their money. Let me pause there. The annuity insurance company does not pocket your money when you buy an annuity and you die early. That money is shared with other annuitants in your annuity pool as what is called mortality credits. The money that would have went to you is shared with all the other living people in that pool. It is often stated, but totally wrong, that the insurance company gets that money. Does the insurance company ultimately get some money when everybody in that pool dies? It's possible. But to me, it's more probable that all the money contributed was actually paid out, maybe not to everyone in the pool because some of them died, but to the people who lived longer, they got a lot of the money that the dead people contributed. How does the insurance company make their money? The insurance company makes their money on annuities, not by keeping dead people's money. They make their money on the yield spread. They get the lump sum money you and every other person in your annuity pool put in. They know their obligations. They know the interest rate they guaranteed the money will earn for all members of the annuity pool. But they get to invest that money between now and when the very last annuity pool member dies. And they get to keep any earnings on that money greater than the interest they're crediting people in the annuity pool. Could everybody in the pool pass away and there's still money, principal, if you will, that was contributed left over? Yes. But that's not really how insurance companies are looking to make their money. They make it on the yield spread. Just wanted to clarify that for people. Anyways, he continues. It seems to me that an annuity seller, or in this case, an insurance company, should ask, have you been turned down for life insurance? If the answer is yes, they should get a better deal on the annuity because they will die, may die sooner. It's kind of the opposite of being rated for life insurance. Mm-hmm. Here, your health rating may allow you to get more coverage. Okay, listener, what you described exists. They're called underwritten annuities. They're generally on the SPIA platform, single premium immediate annuities. And they are about as common as a four-leaf clover. Very few insurance companies offer them, but a few do. I don't know the ratings of the insurance companies that are offering them. You definitely want to deal with a highly rated insurance company when buying a lifetime stream of income. But I do know some insurance companies offer, quote unquote, underwritten SPIAs, where they're going to send you through their underwriting process, making sure you're going to drop dead earlier than normal. But one of the things you may want to do instead to protect yourself, because you seem concerned about the money you put in, you could buy a non-medically underwritten annuity and just ask for an installment refund or lump sum refund. Cash refund is what that goes by. That means you're saying to the annuity writer, if I die before getting all my money back, I want whatever is left over to go to my beneficiaries. Now, that will give you less money. Why? You're not willing to share. If you're not willing to share your dollars with other people if you die early, you don't get to partake in the mortality credits of people in that pool. You just don't. So they're going to give you less money. If you don't want to share, you're not going to get. If you were to qualify for a medically underwritten annuity, you will get more money. You will get more money because the insurance company deems you as someone who will likely pass away earlier. But you're really going to have to look at what that company would give you and compare it and the ratings of that company to what you would get in a more traditional annuity. And if you are worried, and here's the dichotomy here, but this man captures it. I always question the people who say, I want to buy a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. I want longevity insurance. I might live a long time. But I want an installment refund because I want to make sure my family doesn't lose the money if I die early. You're trying to have your cake and eat it too. Are you worried about living a long time? Or are you worried about dying early? If you're worried about dying early or think you're going to die early, don't buy longevity insurance. If you have a health condition, listener, and you feel you're not going to live that long, maybe a lifetime stream of guaranteed income isn't what you should be considering. So it's a dichotomy here. You're not going to be able to have your cake and eat it too, though you will be able to find some annuity companies that will medically underwrite that annuity. But you really got to compare what they're willing to offer compared to what you would get at perhaps a more traditional carrier with a higher rating. Anyways, anything you want to add on that?
No. When you start trying to play the prediction, you know, when am I going to die? So I want to make these decisions. It's a little futile, first of all. You know, I think you should look at protecting the things that concern you the most and realize that sometimes that means in hindsight, when you're dead, you might somehow realize that you wish you would have made a slightly different decision. But I think regrets while dead are not as important to protect against as regrets while living. And I will tell you, if you live too long, live outlive your money, you're going to really regret that while you're alive and it hurts. So I kind of tend to look at it that way. And I'm not a big fan of banking, you know, give me the installment refund or whatever, because it reduces what you're going to get while you're living, which is what you're really trying to protect with one of these. And if it's not that important to you, then why are you even pursuing this kind of product in the first place? So, it is challenging. There's a give and take. Whenever there's a give and take, it's hard to make a decision sometimes.
Okay. Now he has another question, and it has to do with the annuity that I have that I always talk about. And he said, when you and Chris talk about the annuity that you bought, you mentioned it was a good deal. And you both made a point to say we shouldn't get so fixated on a general position that annuities are great or annuities stink. Instead, get fixated on general position that annuities are great or annuities stink. that you don't take the time to evaluate a specific situation. I don't know what that sentence means. Let me jump to the next one.
Instead of, you know, having general opinions about them, assess it from time to time and see if it makes sense and if it fits your needs
yes,
at the time.
Right. Because we do make that point. Make sure the annuity fits. Don't think they all stink, so we're not going to use them, or they're all great and that's all we're going to use. Okay, I get that. He says, but in your case, you said you found a great deal with an income annuity that increases 7% every year until you turn it on. Let me pause there. He is talking about a variable annuity that I bought from an insurance company. I think it was 2007 at this point. It might have been 2008, 7 or 8. Back a long time ago when we called it the arms race between annuity companies. That's what we called it in the industry. Because literally every 9, 10, 12 months, companies would come out with a new version that was better than anything else. And they were just competing against each other.
Share. Yep.
So we called it the arms race. I do have an annuity I purchased back then. I put not much money. I don't know if I ever told people. I think it was 16 grand in there. It was not much that I put inside it. I put 16 grand in and I literally wrote that 16,000 out of my life. When I say I never even opened a statement, that's being a little facetious. I look at the annual statement. I don't even care what the annuity is worth. It is not worth anywhere where you think it would be worth being purchased 15, 18 years ago. I don't care. I look at the other side of the ledger, my income guarantee. I bought that annuity for an income guarantee. It has a liquidity feature that allows me to call the deal off and take my money out. I don't care about that. Now, maybe I would call the deal off and take it out if like the gentleman said, what if you're going to die real soon? But right now, I have no intention of dying anytime soon. I have my AFib under control, and I completely recovered from my stroke. I just look at the income guarantee, and that does go up 7% every year. I knew how much income I got on day one if I wanted to turn it on, and I just keep increasing that 7%. And like math work, it's working, and every year it's showing what I will be getting. He goes on to say, he says, in your case, you found a great deal with an income annuity that increases 7% every year. I agree with your stance, but I am skeptical in nature. And would make me say, this sounds too good to be true. There's got to be something I don't understand. Do you have any comments on that? He asks. Well, I like your skepticism because a lot of annuities are too good to be true. The reason I purchased this annuity is because I said the same thing. This is too good to be true. I remember showing it to Chris and you said, this is too good to be true. This is a really amazing benefit. And I knew we were in the middle of an annuity arms race. And why did I buy it? I have very little Social Security. I shared that with you. I have no pension. I've got no wife. I need more secure income. And I just figured in my head, I might as well put this money in my Roth in, get a lifetime stream of income. It ain't going to be much. It'll be enough, though, to go on an elk hunting trip or a salmon fishing trip every year. And just have this little guaranteed stream of income tax-free and go hunting and fishing every year until I need to use it for something else. That's really what I bought it for. But you are right, listener. These annuities, especially the one I have, are incredibly complex.
I'll tell you one thing we should do, and we'll do this for the next show. I'll research it, is that a typical skeptic like myself and this listener, you know, I'm also lean away from annuities unless there's, you know, clear justification for one. And here I think, you know, wasn't a ton of money, right? $16,000. It wasn't, you know, you're tying up all your wealth in this annuity. So if you've made a bad decision down the road, you're going to super regret it. You know, you kind of wrote it out of your life and it's going to be income for fishing and
hunting
trips, right? What I would say, argue the other side, is let's look at what has happened since 2007. And then, you know, what if you invested that $16,000, what it would it be, and could it buy income now here in 2022 or later that would be better than you having it locked up in there and getting this income benefit increase? And what we'd have to do is look at what your income promise is on there and see, and maybe in hindsight, we talk about it like it seemed like a really great deal. I suspect that it truly still is, but to know for sure, that's what we should really look at.
You can, and if you want to go to that length, you can. The issue I have with that is you use hindsight as if it was known back then. You do something, even in our industry, if a financial advisor is ever sued, you cannot bring in hindsight and say, well, he did this, but he should have did that.
No, I totally get it. I'm not saying
you always look at the information you had at the time. And at the time, I thought I would rather have a steady increase in my account balance, my income balance. And I will say I'm a very conservative investor. I truly am. When Travis, the CFA that we hired, came on board, one of the first things he wanted to do was look and review my portfolio. I don't know if I ever shared this on the podcast. And he reviewed my portfolio. And he reviewed all our client portfolios. Remember, at the time, we were active managers, folks. And I remember he reviewed client portfolios first before he asked for mine. And I always remember this. On the phone, because he lives in Georgia, he said, hey, Jim, I want to see your portfolio. I said, my portfolio? He says, yes, I want to see what your portfolio is. And when I showed it to him, he said to me, I figured it would be conservative. And I said, why? He said, because in all your portfolios, from the aggressive to the conservative, you are on the low end of them. Mm. You take a very conservative stance, even with your aggressive portfolio. Mm. And he said, your biases, even though you didn't know it, were shining through on how you were managing money. That was eye-opening to me, folks, because it was a bias. It was a bias I didn't even recognize when I was actively managing money. I don't actively manage money anymore. We do it all passively. And he picked up on that, Chris. So if you really wanted to play this game, you would have to look at what I normally would have invested that money
well,
in.
Well, no, I think even more conservative than that, because here, to compare apples to apples, you haven't taken any investment risk in this relationship that you have. You're getting the 7%
Precisely.
Increases,
Good
right?
point. So, you would have to compare that to the risk-free
correct,
rate,
correct.
Which since 08 would have been next to nothing.
Correct. Yeah.
What you can't do is say, well, if you would have taken that annuity, which was giving you this guaranteed income stream growing at 7% every year, there was no risk in that annuity, so to speak, you would have to compare it to a risk-free rate, like Chris said, to be truly honest, at which point the annuity blew away anything else.
And why? Because the insurance company on the back end is investing it higher than the risk-free rate, so they're able to give you a bigger promise, and they mitigate their risk in a different way.
And they're taking the risk. Correct. And this annuity was closed. So he says he's skeptical. His skepticism makes perfect sense. The fact that that annuity closed, I don't even think it made it a year in existence. The insurance company realized this is too much. We lowered it, and they lowered it to a 6%. Then they lowered it to, I think, a 5.5%. Mm-hmm. And then they just got rid of that version of the annuity permanently. Again, an annuity purchase, as any insurance purchase is really dependent on the risks that people feel they have. In 2008, as I feel now, my risk is I have no lifetime guaranteed secure income. And my entire retirement planning process, folks, is predicated on making sure your minimum dignity floor is covered by Social Security, pension, and income annuity. I don't have a pension. I had one when I was a cop, but I had to work for 15 years to have that pension vest. I only made it 8.5. I have no income pension. I have very little Social Security, and I shared on the show why. When I was a cop, we never paid into it. Prior to a cop, I was a self-employed landscaper and made precious little. For the first, goodness, 10 years of running my own financial planning firm, I made diddly squat relative to Social Security. If you look at why my benefit is, it's minuscule. It truly is. I freely admit it. But it's because of the situations I've been in. So in 2007, I made a decision to buy income. And I felt that annuity was a wonderful way of doing it because I didn't know of anything else at the time that would guarantee me as much income as they, the insurance company, was willing to guarantee me every year I kept that annuity open. And Chris, I have a need. I have longevity. Well, when I bought it, I didn't know I was going to have a stroke at 57 and be diagnosed with AFib. But when I bought it, I was expecting to live a very long time. So, and I still am expecting to live a long time. According to my doctors, if I can keep my AFib under control, the rest of me is very healthy. I have a very strong heart. It just doesn't beat right. So anyways, there's so many moving parts to this. As to this listener's skepticism, I love it. And when you buy any type of income annuity, short of a SPIA, which is so straightforward, and it's why we use these. And in hindsight, if we're going to use hindsight here, folks, I should have ignored that annuity and been a more aggressive investor. It's the bizarrest thing that someone who was a police officer on the SWAT team for 7 years, has firearms, hunts, hikes, does 12,000-foot peaks. I don't go any higher than that. In other words, lives kind of dangerously at times, is so conservative with his own investments. But I've always been a conservative investor. What I should have done was invest damn aggressively in 2007 and stayed invested aggressively. And maybe I could have bought more income with a SPIA than I'm going to get. But I don't know, and that's looking through the benefit of hindsight. Mm-hmm. I'm a, 'cause even to this day, my portfolio is conservative. Jacob laughs at, well, he doesn't laugh to my face, but he does smile when he sees what I buy in my portfolio. And I just tell him I'm conservative. It's just the way I am. But also, in all honesty, folks, the value to fund my retirement, I've shared this, very little is coming from liquid assets. It's coming from some real estate that I own, and it's coming from the goodwill value of this firm when Chris and I pass it on to future generations. But anyways, that's getting a little too deep. Okay, he has one final question, and it kind of ties into the previous listener, actually. He says, I have a tax question for you guys. It seems many of your questions surround the tax treatment of certain things. And he specifically mentions the woman's case we just answered. Like the woman who several years ago made a Roth contribution, but was ineligible because she got married. Mm-hmm. He asks, do you guys really think the IRS has the ability to successfully track these types of details? I'm skeptical. With the complexity and overworked nature of the IRS, they can actually get to the bottom of these situations. What are your thoughts? It's kind of what we were saying. I agree with you. They're not looking for that. They're not looking for someone who 22 years ago put $2,000 extra into a Roth IRA.
Plus, but, you know, I also view this differently if she did it on purpose, trying to get away with something, versus she made just an honest mistake and it just kind of fumbled through and it's a relatively small dollar amount. And what's the real harm here? That's a different situation for me when I view this and judge it than, oh, look what she was able to pull off. She did this and that, and she hid this and she did that. And that's not at all what seems to have happened here. It's just, suddenly, for whatever reason, she's looking back 22 years and it's dawned on her that there might have been something that didn't happen quite the way it was supposed to at the time. But it's such a small dollar amount that it's certainly not on the priority list for them to go after proactively. Could they stumble across it? Maybe. Could you end up getting your wrist slapped and have to pay a penalty? Certainly. If do you want to clear your conscience and do the right thing, then get out your pen and start doing 5329s. If there is a way to solve it, and that appears to be the way to solve it. And you'll have to just judge for yourself how you want to approach it. That's kind of how I would look at it as well. But I think the IRS catching it, it's justified to be skeptical that it's ever going to get caught, because I think the odds are extraordinarily low.
Okay, so. He has one more question for you.
Whoa.
Yes. Are you ready for it?
I hope so.
I've only been listening to your podcast for a few months, and I don't know what EDU stands for or what an EDU show even is. Yeah. What did I miss?
Good question. Well, that's the domain extension for educational institutions. So the whole concept was we were going to take a topic and make it educational focused about teaching deeply about one particular thing in a show rather than answering multiple questions on the Q&A show. We thought, well, let's call it an EDU show, education show. That's where that comes from. And it's if you go to like Colorado State University's web address is colostate.edu. And, you know, any... Not any, but almost all educational institutions use that EDU domain at the end there instead of .com. So that's where it comes from.
Okay. Do we have time for another annuity question from another listener?
We're running a little long. I personally have time if you want to make this an extended format show. We're at an hour and 15 already.
Yeah, I can go another 10, 12 minutes. I got to go to the doctor's folks in another talking here about my AFib and everything. I have a doctor's appointment at 4. So I'll stay a little while longer and get through this question as well. Because this one could be a few things going on here, and he may need to research it a little bit more. This came in December of 2021. It says, "Hi, Jim and Chris. Hope all is well with you. I'm trying to help my mom with her estate plan. She currently has an annuity my father left to her from the pipe fitters union." And let me pause there. When I hear pipe fitters and union, not necessarily pipe fitters, but union, I'm thinking a pension, which is a form of annuity.
And sometimes are actually with a relationship with an insurance company too.
Correct. I'm not thinking a traditional annuity where you contribute money to it. It's with an insurance company, you're getting an income benefit or a withdrawal benefit. I'm thinking pension. But what he writes next really sounds like a annuity, a type of annuity. So I'm wondering if this pipe fitters union has a fraternal insurance company associated with it. And through the fraternal insurance company, this annuity was purchased. So I'm really confused because he continues. "As I understand it, should my mom pass away before the account value goes to zero, any residual value in the annuity will pay out to her beneficiaries." That, Chris, does not sound like a pension. A pension, if you're taking an income benefit from it, doesn't track your account balance. An annuity with a withdrawal benefit, like we spoke about last week, does track your account balance. So see where I'm getting a little confused here? So I'm not quite sure what he has. Currently, her estate plan has the annuity paying out to her 7 grandchildren through a trust. I realize, and here's another thing he says, "I realize IRAs are not a good idea to go into a trust." So that gets me thinking the mother has an IRA that she inherited from her deceased husband. I'm wondering if she moved it into an IRA in her name or not. Here's what I think happened, Chris and listeners. The husband, somehow, while working for a pipe fitters union, purchased an annuity with what is called a withdrawal benefit. It's the only type of annuity that's going to have this account balance that would pay out if the person dies and there's any money left in it. The advantage to a withdrawal benefit, GMWB, guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, or GMIB, guaranteed minimum income benefit, the advantage to having an annuity like that is many, not all of them, but most of them, when the account balance reaches zero, because they're only giving you some of your money every year until it reaches zero, when it reaches zero, the insurance company will continue making additional payments as if there was still money in the account to give you up until you die. But if you die before the account balance reaches zero at your death, your beneficiaries will get whatever money is in the annuity. I don't think he's talking a traditional union pension. I think he is talking that the husband, the father, must have purchased an annuity with a withdrawal benefit while working for the pipe fitters union. My guess is perhaps a union fraternal organization, I could be wrong on that, that sponsored the annuity. Because he mentioned specifically, Chris, an IRA. I'm guessing the annuity is inside an IRA.
Yeah, and a lot of the unions, though, they have, they call them like annuity funds or annuity trust funds or things like that. And they're a lot of times with multiple entities. So like a multi-employer plan, essentially the where we, what we would call outside of the union environment. So it might just be the terminology or the wording that they're using, but it behaves a lot like a pension where there was. So there could still be more of what we call a pension.
But there is no pension that I know of. I understand multi-employer plans and all of that. Yeah. But there's none that I know of that have an actual account balance.
Right.
And they're going to track it. And should you not take out more than the minimum amount every year and you die with some of it left.
I agree. That one would be odd. I've never seen that either.
I've never seen it. They're all annuitized. Why? Mortality credits. Pensions need mortality credits. People die sooner, don't get as much out as people who live longer, and the money that would have went to the people who died is used to support the people who lived. In a withdrawal annuity, there are no mortality credits. You're not sharing the risk with anyone. The insurance company takes that risk on individually for you. He's describing to me an annuity with a withdrawal benefit that is now in an IRA. He doesn't tell me if the wife, the mother, his mom, the wife of the person who died, is staying as an income beneficiary of the IRA or has moved the IRA into her own IRA and is continuing the annuity through spousal continuation, which is a whole other thing I don't want to get into on today's show. So anyways, listener, I'm just trying to describe what I think might be happening, but I'm not sure. Let's continue with his question. I realize IRAs are not a good idea going into a trust unless they pass through the trust. Yes, I don't want to get deep into that. Listen to our shows on IRAs as trusts as beneficiaries of IRAs. We're not a big fan of the IRA, the trust holding the IRA money, because then it's taxed at very, very, very compressed rates. We would prefer an IRA that passes money out a trust that passes money out, or better yet, no trust at all. Oftentimes people don't need a trust, but they're sold a trust. Anyways, he said, I attempted to send a beneficiary form to the insurance company naming all 7 grandchildren individually. He's trying to get away from this one trust, right, that would then pass it on to 7 beneficiaries and instead name each beneficiary individual on the beneficiary form. But he says the union was not allow multiple beneficiaries. So this now confuses the heck out of me again. What do you mean the union won't allow it? Who is sponsoring this annuity? Is it an annuity? Listener, I'm not quite sure what you have, and I'm not quite sure you know what you have. You really should try to find out, because I've never heard of an insurance company refusing to name multiple beneficiaries on a beneficiary form. It's not to say that they can't, but I've never heard of it for the life of me. So I'm not quite sure what you have. And then he asks, do you see a problem in the way this is set up? If so, is there a better way to handle this? If what you write is true, and they are only going to allow one beneficiary, then to me, you have no choice but to use a trust that simply passes the IRA on to all the other beneficiaries. Depending on how much money is in this, and you don't give me any idea, are we talking $3 million or are we talking $30,000? Mm-hmm. Technically speaking, each beneficiary should have their own sub-trust, and each sub-trust is supposed to be named on the beneficiary form, which it's not going to be allowed. Separate accounts cannot be treated in the trust. So if it just names the trust, and even if the trust says this money then goes into seven separate trusts for each beneficiary, that's not going to qualify for IRA distribution purposes. In order for it to go to each individual beneficiary and allow each beneficiary to stretch it out for 10 years, because that's what's going to happen here, or to close it outright, they need to have subtrusts, listener. But a subtrust needs to be listed on the beneficiary form, and you're telling me it's not going to be allowed. So here's what I see happening, assuming this is even worth it. So if it's a small amount of money, or if all the beneficiaries are just going to want the money, just have the IRA payout. Just pay out. Have your mom's trust simply say, at my death, the IRA pays out to the trust. And the trust is going to pass this money out to all these different beneficiaries, and they will have to deal with the taxes themselves. But if some beneficiaries want to try to, quote unquote, stretch that IRA out for 10 years, it's going to be a pain in the hiney. And I don't know if it's worth doing. And even this, listener, keep in mind, I don't know if your mother is acting as a beneficiary of your dad's IRA, or if she's acting as if this is her own IRA. I don't know. You also didn't tell me, did your dad die pre or post secure? If he died post secure and your mom is staying as a beneficiary, the 10-year clock has already started. Mm-hmm. And by time you kids inherit it, there may not be anything left. I don't know. There's a lot that's missing here. What I would encourage you to do, rather than me just going on and on and on and on about what might be, you really should maybe get a hold of someone at the union or the insurance company who knows what this is and start finding out. Is this truly an annuity at an insurance company? What is the income benefit? Will the income benefit continue if the account balance reaches zero? Why can't you name multiple beneficiaries? If it is an income benefit and there is an account balance, I would look to see if you could get a higher income benefit at another company. Don't outrule that. Not saying to move it, I'm saying to at least do that research. Maybe your mother could be getting more income at another insurance company that will allow you to name multiple beneficiaries. I've never heard of an insurance company not allowing multiple beneficiaries. I've just never heard it. It's crazy. So I don't know. It's a really bizarre case. Give me more information, and I think Chris and I would be happy to opine further.
Yeah, I agree. There's a few strange elements that need to be clarified here, and then maybe an answer will pop out from that. But
exactly. Yeah. Anyways, I wanted to get to it because we try to get to everyone's question. He put it in the annuity category. I just don't know if this guy has an annuity, if he has a pension, if it's at an insurance company, if it's through a fraternal. I don't know if the dad died pre or post secure. I don't know if the mom is treating it as a beneficiary IRA, which was one of the things we determined on another previous email, if you remember. The mom must have treated it as a beneficiary IRA with that TIA CREF issue. There's just too little information for me to give you a sound answer. Sorry.
Sound okay. Good. Okay.
We'll wrap it up there.
Yeah, it's a good spot to wrap, and we do appreciate sending the questions in. If you've got any annuity questions you want to squeeze in during National Annuity Awareness Month, send them on in now. It'd be nice to kind of kill two birds with one stone, have it be the question of the week and be an annuity question. That's always fun. But
if I could interject, sure. I would prefer And I'm trying to do a question of the week that doesn't have to do with an annuity. So we have a Social Security, IRA or planning question, and then we get into annuity questions. What I am doing is if we get new annuity questions, I'm trying to get them on in honor of National Annuity Awareness Month. I still have about three or maybe four old annuity questions that we definitely will get to. And I'll leave it at that. There's another... there's probably going to be an EDU show on an annuity question as well that has to do with private equity firms buying annuity companies and life insurance companies. But that will be a whole EDU show that we'll do on that, not necessarily in June, but at some point. So for that listener, she knows who she is. I did not forget your question. We're actually going to turn it into an EDU show.
Okay. Cool. Well, if you do have a question, send it to Jim's email, jim@jimhelps.com. That's the best place to send it. And anything else we need to say? I don't think so. Sorry.
That's about it. Everybody have a great weekend. This was, again, a Q&A show. We'll start with our EDU show next week. And that's about it. Everybody
Sounds
enjoy
good.
Their weekend.
Okay. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.